You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll be hearing about some big talent packed into a few brief moments at the London Short Film Festival.
I think the whole idea of making films on nothing is quite a big thing at the moment, purely because there is no funding and there is possible to get out there with a camera and just make something.
We'll be meeting the author of a new book that attempts to explain the intricacies of Sharia law. And staying with religion, we'll be hearing from Moscow about the city's renewed fervour for building churches. And we'll take a ride on a timeless classic that's now all brand new. The London Route Master bus gets a well-deserved revamp.
It's almost the only bus that anyone knows the name of, and certainly the only one that anyone has any real kind of fond affection for, it, apart from complete kind of bus nerd.
All that plus some great music here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. So lots to get through in the next 60 minutes. First of all, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Emma. One woman has died and around 20 people have been injured in a stampede at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. Thousands of would-be students had been waiting outside the university for days with only around 800 places available. The crush happened when the campus gates opened this morning. The dead woman was the mother of a student. Blade Nzimande is the country's Minister of Higher Education.
We can't go and punish UJ for what is a national challenge. But nevertheless, given what has happened, the university vice-chancellor is assuring us that there will be an inquiry so that then we can see what needs to be done.
Voters in New Hampshire are taking part in the first primary to select the Republican candidate to take on Barack Obama in November's US presidential election. The latest polls give front-runner Mitt Romney a sizable lead over his rivals. One survey put him on 37%, 19 points ahead of second-place Ron Paul. In last week's Iowa caucus, his winning margin over Rick Santorum was only 8 votes. These voters say it's an important day.
Someone, I think, who has a little different view, who might be a little bit stronger, different ideas, not the same type of politician that we're used to.
I changed my mind about 4 times. Going back and forth between a number of the candidates. There's no easy decision. You have to look at all the candidates and
Five people were killed on Sunday after gunmen entered a police station in northern Peru and opened fire, killing 3 police officers and 2 civilians. According to reports, gunmen entered the Villa Santa Rosa police station in Cajamarca and killed the local police commissioner and 2 of his officers. The wife and 13-year-old son of one of the dead officers were also killed. According to police, the attack was carried out in order to steal weapons from the headquarters. Latvia's Prime Minister says he's determined to stick to his goal of adopting the euro in 2 years. Valdis Dombrovskis said today he was undeterred by the single currency zone's continuing deep crisis. In an interview, he said the Baltic state aimed to raise funds on financial markets to refinance its debts as soon as possible, but he wanted its credit rating to be upgraded first. That had been delayed by the eurozone problems, he said. But he added that he was confident that the eurozone was up to the challenge of dealing with the current situation. The former footballer Eric Cantona says he announced that he planned to run for the French presidency because he wanted to highlight the plight of millions of poor and homeless people in France. He told the Libération newspaper that housing is a problem which is treated with contempt, but the newspaper made it clear that he would not, in fact, be running for president. The country's housing minister, Natalia Kosciuszko-Morizet, said he was highlighting a real issue and he was right to do so. A theatre group in the German capital Berlin has denied claims of racism after allowing a white actor to use black makeup to play a black character. The Schlosspark Theater is using the technique in its latest production, I'm Not Rappaport. The play, set in New York, portrays the friendship between 2 elderly men, one Jewish, the other African-American. The company says it couldn't find the right elderly black actor for the part, and many white actors have used black makeup in the past. But critics say they're emulating minstrel shows in the United States, which traditionally lampooned black people. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
In Western Europe, let's start with France and the UK. The mild weather here will continue for another couple of days. Many major cities around 10 Celsius or higher after that. It's all change. Certainly in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe, a change on the way. Much colder over the next day or two already, with frosts and some snow. In fact, getting colder in all parts of Europe by the weekend. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. And in London, still mild, 11 degrees, partly cloudy. Frankfurt, 8 Celsius, partly cloudy. In Warsaw, 5 and cloudy. In Budapest, around 8 and cloudy. In North America, we're looking at a midweek storm here, which will affect the eastern US from Florida all the way to the Carolinas. Eventually, it'll reach New York State and Maine. Lots of rain and generally unpleasant weather. Across the border in Toronto, Ottawa, a rain and snow mix to come. Meanwhile, the good weather continues on the Pacific side in Nevada and California. Tons of sun. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In San Francisco, 18 Celsius with sunny skies. In Las Vegas, 14 degrees, sunny as well. Chicago, 10 Celsius and sunny, but note, snow on the way Thursday for Chicago O'Hare. In New York City, 6 degrees and sunny. And look at other world destinations. In Cape Town, we've had some hot weather recently, into the 30s. A cold front is approaching and temperatures will be only 21 on Friday with rain showers and a cool breeze. In the Caribbean, Barbados, 27 and sunny. The British Virgin Islands, 28 with sunshine. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Just coming up to 7 minutes past the top of the hour here on Monocle 24, you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Lagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanelia.
The Propa Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today by casting our eyes at the world of business, because each day this week on Midori House, we'll be catching up with our editors to get an idea of the latest news in their field of expertise. Today it's the turn of our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, to lead us through the latest stories which have been catching his eye.
Well, one story that jumped out to me, it was a story that was all over the press yesterday, and it's a new acquisition in digital media, a company which we profiled actually at the very beginning of The Entrepreneurs called ZBox, has recently, Sky's bought a 10% stake in them. And we had Anthony Rose, who's the co-founder and chief technology officer, in kind of talking us through the product. And what was really interesting for me is that they're part of this return to TV. I mean, there was this big moment when there was all streaming AV online, and you saw really strong propositions coming out from terrestrial broadcasters like BBC iPlayer, 4 On Demand. Everyone thought the future of watching content was all going to be streamed, it's all going to be online, we're going to be doing it on tablets. There's a move now which is saying, actually, the TV experience is a really valuable one. It creates, there's a kind of difference between push and pull. There's a communal value to these slightly more established media models.
Everyone and there's a gathering around the television set.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a real reinvestment in it. So, I mean, I'm not, as someone who doesn't own a TV and someone who finds it fairly difficult to sit through an entire movie, I wasn't the best placed person for Anthony Rose to pitch his product at, but I can try and sum it up for you. And essentially what it is he is collapsing the different services that a social network and a TV content provider would provide. So they noticed that, and he's got a great kind of form in this, because he was one of the men who developed BBC iPlayer at the BBC. And he basically noticed that when people watch content, they're also interacting. So they'll, you know, for example, people will be watching a big blockbuster show like X Factor, and they'll be on their BlackBerry or they'll be on their tablet, and they'll be communicating with people. He said that that doesn't need to be two different services. You can collapse the two. So what you have is a kind of, yeah, a
swirling
sensory
overload.
I mean, maybe it's something for the kids, Amy. I'm not sure, but it's
not sure how to take that, Jonathan. But okay, sure, one for the kids. Mm-hmm. But also, what I think is interesting is the point that you raised, which is that there have been reports that the under 25 sector really doesn't own as many TVs as the older demographic does. And so it is interesting that they're trying to pitch this as the new product for the younger sect.
Well, I think that's why Anthony came across as a really fascinating entrepreneur when we interviewed him, which, like I said, was way back when, before any of this came out, is because he had the ability to kind of look beyond what seemed to be happening in the market, the kind of herd mentality, and he said, actually, you know what, there's life in the old bird yet. And he's created what looks like a really strong proposition for TV, and certainly Sky seemed to be saying so by buying a 10% stake.
I was just going to ask you, are there any other developments in the TV market?
Well, there are. I mean, it's been all over the press recently as well, but what's being seen as Steve Jobs' kind of last hurrah, the ITV, small I, not to be confused with the broadcaster ITV, capital I, but ITV, which is basically Apple TV, being billed as the great man's last huge vision. And essentially, it's an interactive TV set. So it's the next step in things like the Wii or the Xbox Kinect that we've seen. It's this swirling world of content and trying to reimagine how people are going to be organising and using their content. It should be said it's a complicated market at the moment, and especially with the likes of Netflix, perhaps trying to turn things around, expanding abroad, reaching new markets. There's a lot of movement, there's a lot of things happening, but certainly in the press at the moment, it seems like there's some interesting stories.
And often I think what happens with these things is they get rolled out and, you know, there are a lot of kinks to work out, a lot of bugs in the system, working out actual user habits versus perceived user habits. And then, after about a year or two, they can usually really refine the product and make it something that people actually do use and want to buy.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, you can focus group these things to death, but at the end of the day, it's only when you actually see them roll out that you see the proof of how people actually enjoy content.
Speaking of technology, big show, CES, is going on in Vegas at the moment. What's the
Huge.
Big news out of there?
Yeah, I mean, CES, massive, been going for 4 decades now. Or something around that, and I actually was doing this show this morning with Rob, and we checked in with David Phelan at CES, and he was talking us through some of the big trends there. And again, we had this huge story about TVs was the big story there as well. You've got the likes of Samsung and Philips really trying to this one-upmanship of who can produce the biggest and thinnest TV, and there's an element of There's a slight element of kind of willy waving going on here, trying to, you know, these products are kind of like 90-inch monstrosities. They're never really going to reach a Dixon's near you.
No, because you need to have a McMansion in order to, you know, to house one of these.
It's very much like, it's like how lots of countries compete against each other to have the world's tallest building or whatever. I mean, these are kind of imaginations of what a TV can be. But again, that was a big story that David picked up for us at CES.
Okay, and tell us what we can expect to hear in the new Entrepreneur Show this week.
Yes, so that'll be airing tomorrow at 1900 hours London time. And we're doing a retail special this week because obviously the menswear season's kicking off in Europe. Starts on Thursday with Pitti Uomo in Florence, and then followed hotly by Milan and Paris after that. So we're kind of revisiting good retail models. Again, we've got a slight digital aspect to this in that the e-commerce has certainly shaken up the way that fashion retail's approached. But what we did is we revisited some really great independents and people who are producing bricks and mortar in a interesting and innovative way, and keeping market share from online groups such as Gilt Group or ASOS or Net-a-Porter. And we had a report from New York on a great company called CHCM, and we had a couple of great independent retailers from London in the studio, so it's an interesting one.
Okay. Sounds good. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, I think so.
That was Monocle's Amy Gutman talking to our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, earlier on today. Time now for some music. This is the Detroit Emeralds with You're Getting a Little Too Smart. That was the Detroit Emeralds with You're Getting a Little Too Smart. In a moment, we'll be talking about Moscow's recent church-building epiphany, so stay with us.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. with interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture, and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. Now it's time to head to Moscow, where the Russian Orthodox Church has seen something of a revival in the last year. 200 new churches are in the process of being built in the capital alone. It's said to be an effort to relieve overcrowded and unsightly high-rise buildings. We're joined on the phone now to assess the situation by Rachel Muraji in Moscow. Rachel, a very warm welcome to Midori House. Just tell me, 200 new churches in the process of being built. That must be quite dramatically changing the landscape of Moscow.
Well, Moscow is a very big city, and most people don't live in the centre where you would see. In fact, there is a church on almost every block, but further out in these horrible high-rise estates, which are really featureless and grey, and so it will be. You know, it will change the landscape, but probably not the landscape that tourists see so much as perhaps areas that a lot of people live in.
But, I'm just thinking of the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour in Moscow. That was utterly destroyed in Stalin's time and was rebuilt in the 1990s. So obviously there is some sort of symbolic change happening in Moscow.
Well, there's been a huge revival of the Orthodox Church in the last few decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think it's probably partly tied with the search for a Russian identity, because during the Soviet times, Russia was the head of an empire, and you know, you had the Soviet identity, which meant that, you know, whether you were Tajik or whether you were Polish, you could still say that you were living in part of the Soviet state. But now Russia has to reimagine for itself, you know, what it means to be Russian, and the Orthodox Church is a large part of that.
Now, when you talk about Russians seeing themselves as Orthodox, I mean, the vast majority of Russians, I understand, see themselves as being Orthodox, but is it more a matter of culture than of genuine faith, as is the case in many Western countries nowadays?
I think, a bit of both. I think that a lot of Russians would say that most Russians would identify themselves as Orthodox, which is why the Kremlin is always so keen to stay on the right side of the Orthodox Church and why the Patriarch Kirill's statements are quite important. But, not everybody is a fervent believer. But I think there's a lot more sort of ardent belief here than there is perhaps, well, certainly in the UK, and say large parts of Western Europe, where, you know, people weren't deprived of their religion for a long time in the West. Whereas in Russia, this is something novel. This is something that people haven't had. And so, you know, in the last 20 years, people are gravitating towards it again. And remember that although a lot of people in Russia have got a lot richer, Russia has more billionaires than ever, the Gini coefficient here, the inequality between the rich and the poor, is ever wider. It's the widest of all the BRIC countries, more than Russia, more than China, more than India. And so for a lot of people, particularly pensioners, their lives haven't got any better.
So do you think
so the church is something that gives them, you know, a sense of comfort, a sense of identity?
Is it also perhaps the opportunity to reclaim a past that was maybe taken away from them by the Soviet era?
Yes, I think that's certainly true. And it's very, if you've ever been to an Orthodox church service, it's very beautiful. It's the opposite of kind of our Anglican kind of pared back aesthetic. You know, it's very much the bells and smells. It's incense and icons and beautiful artwork. So these 200 churches, which I think they broke ground on the they announced the project in April and broke ground on the first one in the latter half of last year. You know, decoration for these churches is obviously quite an important thing because Russian churches are full of beautiful gilt artwork.
You were talking a moment ago about the Kremlin keen to stay on the side of the Russian Orthodox Church. To what degree is politics allied to the church in Russia?
Certainly, Patriarch Kirill is seen as somebody who is a Kremlin supporter. During the opposition demonstrations, he came out against social networking sites which had been used to organize a lot of the demonstrations. But at the same time, he's now said that it's important that these demonstrations go ahead and that the Kremlin needs to talk to demonstrators. So, you know, he has an independent voice and an independent role, and I think that the Kremlin likes to curry the favor of the church.
Let's go back to these.
And anybody who's got any sense in Russia wants to stay in power wants to curry the favor of the Kremlin.
Because Putin has very famously allied himself to the Russian Orthodox Church in the last two or three years, is in an effort to sort of grasp a few more voters. Is that right?
I think also, you know, Putin is now having to look for new sources of support, because for a long time people's lives got a lot better after the Soviet Union. All he had to do was deliver stability. But now he's now scrabbling around for a new identity, which is something that we can see quite clearly in the wake of all these demonstrations.
Now, you're talking about very ornate, very beautiful churches. I read somewhere that the new buildings have been criticised of being a sort of an ecclesiastical version of prefab Soviet architecture. What's the style that they're going for? And does it actually, create a genuine sense of faith?
Well, I think anything, if you've ever been to a Soviet housing estate. I mean, when you drive out of Moscow and you get out of the city centre, you just get into the miles and miles and miles of identikit concrete blocks. And so to be able to build something that is as beautiful as the kind of things that were destroyed would obviously be difficult, but to be able to build something that adds a touch of beauty, something in the middle of these rather soulless estates that can lift people's spirits, I think wouldn't be that hard. And really, whatever you do in terms of a new project to do with, you know, mass construction, you're always going to attract criticism.
Rachel, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Rachel Moraji in Moscow telling us about 200 new churches which are in the process of being built in Moscow alone. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be jumping on London's brand new double-decker buses. But first, here's some music and Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Sharon Jones of the Dap Kings there and Genuine. Stay with us on Monocle 24 while we'll be looking at the London Short Film Festival in the next half hour. First, though, let's get the latest news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Emma. One woman has died and around 20 people have been injured in a stampede at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. Thousands of would-be students had been waiting outside the university for days with only around 800 places available. The crash happened when the campus gates opened this morning. Voters in New Hampshire are taking part in the first primary to select the Republican candidate to face Barack Obama in November's US presidential election. The latest polls give front-runner Mitt Romney a sizable lead over his rivals. Five people were killed on Sunday after gunmen entered a police station in northern Peru and opened fire, killing three police officers and two civilians. Gunmen entered the police station, killed the local police commissioner and two of his officers, and the wife and 13-year-old son of one of the dead officers were also killed. Latvia's prime minister says he's determined to stick to his goal of adopting the euro in 2 years. Valdis Dombrovskis said today he was undeterred by the single currency zone's continuing deep crisis. The former footballer Eric Cantona says he announced that he planned to run for the French presidency only because he wanted to highlight the plight of millions of poor and homeless people in France. A theatre group in the German capital Berlin has denied claims of racism after allowing a white actor to use black makeup to play a black character in its latest production. The Schlosspark Theater says it couldn't find the right elderly black actor for the part, and many white actors have used black makeup in the past.
Thank you. Thanks very much indeed, Barney. Barney will be back in just under half an hour with a full update on today's news. In a moment, we're joined in the studio by the author of a new book on Sharia law. But first, a bit more music. This is Povo Jazz with Another Day.
Find the love you always had and go stronger if you last another day.
And that was Povo Jazz with Another Day. Sadaqat Kadri has been a barrister specialising in international criminal and constitutional law. At the same time, he's carved out a career as a travel writer. Past subject matters include a history of the trial, but his latest book focuses on Islamic law. Heaven on Earth is billed as a journey through Sharia law. And I'm very pleased to say he now joins us in the studio. Sadaqat, a very warm welcome to Midori House. Thank you very much for joining us. Could you just take us right back to the origins of Sharia law for those who aren't familiar with it?
Sure. Well, I wasn't familiar with it myself when I first started writing the book. It obviously originates with the origins of Islam itself, which is at the beginning of the 7th century, according to the Christian era. The revelations that were handed down to the Prophet, according to Muslims, began in the year 620. And then the Prophet died in the year 630. So that's the origin. That's the first laws that were handed down, the first Muslim laws that were handed down. But then that was only the very beginning. The Quran was written down over subsequent years, but it was another three centuries before Islamic law was fully codified, and it was argued about for centuries after that. And of course, it's notoriously being argued about even today.
That was leading to me to my next question. You say it's been argued about for centuries, but for those of us who only have a passing knowledge of Sharia law, it seems to be an area of total development, but also conflict and uncertainty.
Oh, yeah, it's hugely controversial. I mean, that was the main reason that I wanted to write this book, because I'm born a Muslim. I come from a Muslim family and I'm a lawyer. But I myself didn't know. I knew virtually nothing about Sharia law when I first started writing this book. So what I wanted to do was find out what the history of this subject was, just as I'd done previously in my earlier book with Western law. So I went round. The first half of the book is a history. The second half of the book was me travelling between my father's birthplace in northern India and, eventually I ended up in Egypt, but I went through Pakistan, Iran and Turkey and Syria and Lebanon on the way, just talking to people, ordinary believers, but also clerics, muftis. I visited lots of madrasas, and just tried to find out what the different interpretations of Islamic law were.
Because at the key of it is interpretation, isn't it? It's purposive, is the way that we read Sharia law. How do different nations cope with interpreting something which has one global set of rules?
Well, it doesn't have one global set of rules. That's the very interesting thing that I found out. I mean, there's a huge range of interpretations of it. I mean, on the one hand, you do have countries like Malaysia, which are extremely liberal in the Muslim context. On the other hand, you have countries like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Iran, which are incredibly illiberal. The question of how they interpret it, according to the clerics themselves, they'll often say, well, we don't interpret it. We're simply repeating the word of God verbatim. But of course, that's not true. They interpret it in a hundred different ways, sometimes very, very brutal ways, illiberal ways. It was what I wanted to do was set out the history in order to give people the means to make people just realise how contentious this thing has been over the years and over the centuries.
It's not only internally contentious, as you say, with different interpretations within different cultures, but it also can often come up against domestic law as well. I mean, what experience did you have of that?
Domestic law in this country, you mean?
Or in any of the countries that you visited, which may necessarily have their own constitution and their own set of domestic legal, their own domestic legal system. And yet you have Sharia law as well, and they can occasionally come into conflict with each other.
Well, there's a very important distinction that became apparent to me at the very beginning of writing the book. One is between the Sharia, according to Muslims, simply means the correct way of doing things. It means path in Arabic. But then there's another word, fiqh, which means understanding, and that's the human interpretation of the Sharia. And fiqh is the contentious aspect of the Sharia. Almost every Muslim who understands the meaning of the word would say they believe in the Sharia. The question is how it's interpreted, and it's potentially it potentially causes a lot of problems in terms of constitutional law. But most Muslim states will say that they pay heed to the Sharia or observe the Sharia. The question is then what they do, for example, with, to take the most contentious example, criminal law, because there are some interpretations of Sharia law which are notoriously violent. You know, the requirements of, for amputation of thieves, stoning of adulterers, etc. And it's actually a very small number of Muslim countries which even purport to impose those penalties, let alone actually carry them out.
Looking very briefly at your book, the subject matter that you take seems to be categorised, and do correct me if I'm wrong here, seems to be categorised into subject matters which would immediately provoke associations from a Western audience. For example, you're looking at the questions of punishment and the questions of jihad. Did you consciously do that, or was that just the way that the book turned out?
It was both, actually. It was the way that the book turned out, because I started off in my dad's hometown because that seemed a rational place to start, and I wound up travelling through countries like Pakistan and Iran where those issues and via... I didn't actually go to Afghanistan and Iraq, but obviously they war is central to what's going on in that region. So it was very relevant to my journey. But also I could take for granted the fact that people accept that Muslims can be liberal and humane. You know, I know that they can. I've no doubt that they can. And I write that, and I write all about that in my book. But I thought that the most important things to address were why certain hardline interpretations of Islam have come to the fore in recent years. And it is only in the last 40 years that they've come to the fore. That's one of the most important aspects of the book that I point out. It's only since the 1970s that these very hardline interpretations have kind of gained precedence.
I'm talking to Sadaqat Qadri, who's the author of Heaven on Earth, Built as a Journey Through Sharia Law. You were talking, Sadaqat, a moment ago about how the concept of Sharia law has really sort of come to the fore in the last 40 years. Arguably, it's just over in the last decade when it's really, really come to the fore. And I was thinking back at things like George W. Bush and his sort of religious bent when he went into Afghanistan and also the great Labour government, We Don't Do God. Do you think Sharia law has come up in conflict or has been positioned as an opposing point of view from a more Western Christian position?
Yes, there's no doubt about that at all. I was in the United States during 9/11, and I heard George Bush say, when he said that, you know, the whole of the world's now been divided into two camps, you're either with us or against us. Osama bin Laden said almost literally exactly the same thing 2 weeks after that. The world was divided for those who wanted to see the division, and there were people on both sides who wanted to see that division. On the Muslim side, there were many people who came to regard their faith as a badge of identity against what they perceived of as Western aggression. And the Sharia for them, Islamic law for them, became a mark of that identity and something which the more it was attacked, the more they felt it was necessary to defend it. And, you know, again, that's not it's comprehensible, but it's not a sensible way to on which to understand the actual history of Islamic law. And that's what I wanted to do with the book.
Let's bring it up to date, because I think you say you ended up in Egypt, didn't you?
I ended in, yes, that's right, yes.
And Egypt is where, in the last few days, we've heard that Islamist parties will make up, or are predicted to make up to 2/3 of the new lower house in the Egyptian parliament. Salafism is resurgent in Egypt. The Tunisians have elected a coalition government which has an Islamist element to it. Obviously, Sharia law is becoming incredibly relevant in a modern political and legal structure. How do you see it panning out?
Oh, well, that's a vast question, isn't it?
Sorry.
No, it's also an obvious question. The Muslim Brotherhood was always going to do well in those elections. It's no surprise. The Muslim Brotherhood has been the most powerful movement in that part of the world for more than the last half century. The Salafis, that's more interesting, the extent to which they gained a share of the popular vote in Egypt. Any Muslim country in that region is going to pay heed to its interpretations of the Sharia. There's no avoiding that, and it's absolutely pointless, futile to try and stand against that. But what one can hope for is humane interpretations of the Sharia, and I'm not unoptimistic about that. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood has always been characterized by gradualism. It's always been characterized by pragmatism, and despite the fact that it now does have in the Egyptian context to reckon with people of a more hardline bent, the so-called Salafis, it's very unclear as yet what those Salafis want. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if the demands of some of the more extreme elements are moderated as the realities of power become clearer to those who've succeeded in recent elections.
There's a line in your book, though. I mean, I only briefly went through it, and I must apologise, which said that there are fears that a new radicalisation is imminent. What does that mean?
Well, it means what I said, that there are fears that a new radicalisation is imminent, because there are lots of people who, until the last year, would have regarded the Muslim Brotherhood as an extremist organisation. In fact, there are a lot of people who today regard the Muslim Brotherhood in the West who regard the Muslim Brotherhood as an extremist organisation. As I say, I don't think that that's. I don't think it's a fair characterisation of the Muslim Brotherhood. I certainly don't think that it's an effective or a useful way of characterising the Muslim Brotherhood, because they are going to be a force to be reckoned with in Egypt and in many other countries in that region. And it's very, very important that the West, countries outside that region, deal with them on equal terms.
Sadar Qadri, who's the author of Heaven on Earth, A Journey Through Sharia Law. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. The time is 14 minutes before the top of the hour.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
For the next 5 days, London's boutique cinemas will be hijacked by what's been described as the best short film festival in the world. Now in its 9th year, the London Short Film Festival is one of the few one-stop showcases for new and established filmmakers. In a climate where competition is increasingly keen and funding harder to come by, more than 900 filmmakers have fought to be one of just over 200 exhibitors. Well, earlier today, the festival's director, Philip Ilson, joined me in the studio and he told me about how the festival had developed over the last 9 years.
Well, that's one of the main things that has happened. It has spread out. First year, we were just 4 days in the ICA, and then it expanded to the Curzon. And then in the last 2 or 3 years, we've gone into more and more venues as they get in touch with us and say, do you want to do a screening or two here at the festival? So this year, we're sort of in the Cine Lumiere for the first time, and the Hackney Picture House for the first time because it's just opened. So yeah, we kind of get approached. We don't have to go out and look for the venues.
That must be very, very satisfying. And does that mean, as a result, that more people want to have their films shown with you?
Yeah, I think it's important for short filmmakers to have their films shown in reputable venues. I mean, my background before I started the festival was running short film nights in bars in London and places, which are great fun. And there are those kind of events going on a regular basis even now. But when we started the festival, it was to get short films into sort of places like the Curzon Soho, which is nice for the filmmakers to have that kind of experience in a reputable cinema.
And where does a short film fit in the greater scheme of cinema in London?
In terms of in cinemas, there's very few places you can see short films in cinemas outside of festivals, other than a scheme like the Virgin Media Shorts, which sometimes pops shorts in front of features, but these are more like 90-second, two-minute ads. They're not fully formed films, because film can be 90 seconds, but they're very limiting in terms of what you can do in that space of time.
So outside these very small limited festivals, where does the short filmmaker get their outlet?
I think the festivals are quite big for short filmmakers, to be honest. I mean, some of the bigger festivals like London and Edinburgh have big audiences for short films. And a lot of these, as I said, these other film nights are quite successful. Obviously, the other bigger outlet for more audiences is online, but, you know, online is very important for filmmakers to get really out there internationally and to get their name shown. But then the trouble with online is it's very vast with millions of things. I think having a festival that's curated, even though the audiences are smaller, 100 or 150 people in a cinema, it's kind of more focused, I think.
What about funding? Because the demise of the UK Film Council pulled the oxygen from lots of filmmakers.
It did.
What happened? How are they getting their money?
It's interesting because we did a call for entries this year, and as you may know, we are a British short film festival in the sense that we only focus on British-made work. And we got 900 films this year, 800, 900 films, and that's quite a shock seeing that there's literally no funding anymore left for doing short films. I know that the BFI, who've taken over from the Film Council, are going to be setting up other short film schemes, so there will be funding there. I don't think that's an issue, but I mean, it's quite cheap to make a short film now, and if you really want to go out there and do it, you can do it. And if you get a film made on your own money or for virtually nothing, and then you get it into a good festival or a, you know, a good slot wherever, then it helps to get you seen to move your career on.
Because there's a new phenomenon known as crowdfunding as well. What's that?
Crowdfunding is where literally does what it says on the tin. You basically get money coming in from vast amounts of people, small amounts, and then they all get some sort of credit. It's quite big in documentary film rather than in short film at the moment, I think.
Now, a couple of months ago, we were at the Documentary Festival in Amsterdam.
All right.
And a lot of the subject matter there was deriving its sources from social media, people making their own films out of stuff that had cost them nothing to make, or were gathering in, were creating documentaries out of things such as the Arab Spring, where everything was available and freely available.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in the short film area that might be comparable in terms of a new wave?
That's a good question. You mentioned documentary. We do show a lot more documentary than other short film festivals, because, like you said, it's very cheap to just get out there with a camera and make a documentary. So we do have four or five programs of docs within the festival itself. In terms of drama, again, it's kind of across the board, really. As I said, you can make a film on nothing, and we do really like to focus on films that are made on nothing. We do have a low-budget program every year, but then within some of the other programs, we like to sort of include films that a very low budget to give those filmmakers a chance to be seen against films that have got bigger budgets. But in terms of subject matter, I mean, there's no themes particularly coming out. I mean, people like making comedies, people like making romantic films. That's kind of ongoing year after year, social dramas. You don't see many big action films in short film, but you do see there's a fair amount of horror, always been a lot of horror, not much sci-fi though. So yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I think the whole idea of making films on nothing is quite a big thing at the moment, purely because there is no funding and there is possible to get out there with a camera and just make something.
So if we were to wander down to, let's say, the Curzon Soho in the next couple of days, would you be confronted with a sort of series of, like, a very nice cinematic buffet that you could dip into and pick up different
films? Yeah, that's
films.
What the festival is. I mean, we've been talking about the short films that have been entered to the festival, but I think with the London Short Film Festival, we like to sort of see what's going out there in London as well, in terms of other events and other screenings and other people doing interesting stuff. And we're doing quite a big focus on celluloid this year, because there's a bit of a scene of people starting up nights where they will show films on 16mm projectors or Super 8 projectors, using stuff that they might have bought on eBay, old sort of family Super 8 films, which we did at Hackney on Friday night, which was a great show with live music, and we're doing another one of those later this week. So yeah, it's kind of those, focusing on those kind of other things that are happening as well, other nights, other events and other interesting events and people that are doing stuff in London, as well as just the short film. So in that sense, it is a smorgasbord, is that the right word, of stuff that's all film related, short film related.
And finally, if we were to take a filmmaker who's possibly going to win a prize this year at the Short Film Festival, where does this generally lead to?
Well, because the festival's been going for 9 years, there's a couple of people that have obviously moved on in that time. We were always a very big supporter of Andrea Arnold before she won the Oscar for the short that she made, Wasp, and obviously she's done quite well in a few years with films like Fish Tank and Wuthering Heights. We always try and focus on a filmmaker in the festival who has got a body of work. This year we're doing a retrospective of Paul Wright and of Sean Conway, two filmmakers that no one's obviously heard of, but they're all, both of those, well, Paul Wright won a BAFTA for his short last year, but he's now, you know, developing a feature. Last year we did a retrospective of Ruth Paxton, who's also developing a feature. So it's, again, it's another aspect of the festival that we do like to sort of see what filmmakers are out there and that have got, you know, a body of work that can now be seen. Although they do get very disturbed when we say we're going to do a retrospective of your work, and they're like, well, I'm only 27. Yes. But it's important to focus on those people that are the next generation, that are the next Andrea Arnolds or Lynn Ramseys or those kind of directors.
And that was Philip Ilson, the director of the London Short Film Festival, talking to me earlier. Well, here on Midori House, we stay in London because in the run-up to the 2008 mayoral election, Boris Johnson made a quite infamous promise to bring back the iconic hop-on, hop-off Routemaster bus model. It was more or less withdrawn from regular service in 2005. Design lovers are now rejoicing as the new Routemaster is set to hit the pavement in 2012. I hope not literally, though. Our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, caught up with Travis Elbra, a bus enthusiast and author of the 2005 book The Bus We Loved.
When I first moved to London, they were how I got around. I lived in Hackney, so I didn't have a tube line, and I just found they were a great way of orientating one's way around London. The tube map is kind of an abstract design in a way, and people inhabit it almost as if it's a kind of electrical circuit board. Whereas bus maps are this strange spaghetti-like stream of consciousness of the city, which somehow or other, when I was first in London, seemed to equate much more closely to that, what I was experiencing of the city.
Life above ground.
Yeah, and the spindly arteries and all this stuff. And the Routemaster bus, it's a very beautiful design of it's a very humane design in a sense. It had those curves, it has a driver and a conductor, this great double act, little details like, you know, they had almost a school orchestra triangle bell which you'd ring in order to get off. And of course, it had the open platform, so you could journey along, you know, with the city beneath you, practically.
But this was one of my first experiences of being in London and being quite scared to hop on and hop off. And
yes, yeah.
Yeah, this is something that everybody lamented.
There was a certain degree of risk involved, exactly, in this, which again was part of the appeal in a way, because the bus treated you as if you were an adult.
Exactly, and you were just hopping on and hopping off and being very connected with the streets the whole time.
Precisely.
And something that the bendy buses, when they were introduced, completely eliminated.
They did. They essentially had all the aesthetics of a Hoover attachment in comparison to the Routemaster. I mean, part of the impetus for writing the book really was to try and untangle what on earth it was about this particular bus. I mean, really, it's almost the only bus that anyone knows the name of, and certainly the only one that anyone has any real kind of fond affection for, apart from complete kind of bus nerds. And I wasn't, a transport buff by any means. I came to it as a user and as a writer, really. The fact that these things, you know, glide through our consciousness, both a real one, i.e. having lived through the city, but also kind of iconically in films and on postcards and books and these things. So I was trying to unpick what on earth it was about this particular bus which managed to kind of achieve all that. I mean, to go back to its kind of core details in a way, it was the last bus built in London for London by Londoners, and it grows in a sense from a post-war period of social improvement and optimism. The first discussions about it begin in 1948, same year as the kind of National Health Service, and London Transport at that time is this huge kind of monolithic organisation, very centralised, almost kind of Soviet. There's a museum, a place called the Acton Depot Museum out in West London, which is extraordinary, almost kind of voyage into a lost world of London Transport. It has this room called the Small Items Room, where, you know, you discover that, you know, London Transport had its own range of food products for all the canteens. It had sports fields. It was this monolithic, almost kind of Soviet organisation.
Exactly, symbol of progress.
Yeah, and the design elements and that centralised idea and mass scale produced these things like the Routemaster, and the Routemaster was the kind of last instantiation of that. It's also a bus, which is its technology comes out of the war. London Transport Engineers were involved in building kind of Hadley Page bombers during the Second World War, and they used some of the techniques that they'd put to use in those kind of things into building this new bus. And it was built of lightweight aluminium. Its design was almost like a Meccano set. You could take it apart and put it back together, and it was interchangeable, so it could be recycled. And so, you know, it had all these kind of these elements. And one of the other elements of it was that it was supposed to be as comfortable as a contemporary car.
And that was the bus lover Travis Elborough talking to Hugo MacDonald about London's resurgent Routemaster bus. Hugo will be back in 3 hours when he'll be joined by the foreign editor Steve Bloomfield with the Monocle Daily. That's it from Midori House today. The programme was produced by Paul Noble. Studio manager was Annex Funnell. I'm Emma North. From all of us, goodbye.